Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we have a fabulous group of people. The topic will be Mitzitza Bepeh. It's a controversial topic that's been in the news off and on for the last number of years because the authorities claim that there are children who occasionally get herpes because very common in many parts of the population, people have blisters in their mouth. In fact, they say 65% of people have oral herpes. That's when you get blisters on your lips or inside those painful cold sores that when they're transferred to a child can create a disease. It's a virus, and in a child at that age could be very dangerous. So they want to stop it through a tube, and in many communities they have. So discussing this, and this has been highly litigated in the courts, Mayor Bloomberg, you know, put certain laws into effect to try to eliminate it, caused a big outrage, that went to court. So we will have Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt, the head of infectious diseases. He's both a big Talmud Chacham, he's a Rav, as well as a physician, head of infectious diseases in Nassau Hospital. We will have Rabbi David Zwiebel of the Agudah. We will have Rabbi Daniel Cohn, who represented the Agudah in court. He's an infectious disease physician. And we will have Rabbi Berman, who is a Moyel, who has been, he has done 50 years of Mila, as well as has done over 15,000 Brisin, who testified for the Agudah as well. So we have a very interesting group of Rabbanim, as well as physicians, to discuss this week. You can listen to us on 11 to 12 midnight on WMCA 570 AM on the Nachum Segal Network, or at Monday morning 11 AM on the NachumSegal.com. You can also listen to us always at headlinesbook.com under the audio or podcast section. You can also always listen to us on our hotline at 732-806-8700, the current topic, or any of our past topics as well. You can also email any of your questions or comments to info@headlinesbook.com. Well, this week we read about Parsha Saita, the story of the adulterous, the adulterous affair. And the word Saita comes from the word shtus. The Torah of the opinion opines to us that affairs come from fantasies. In other words, they don't come from something genuine, a genuine desire, but they come from a fantasy. Something is better over there, better than it is at home. And you know, how do they catch monkeys in the jungle? And why is this relevant? Because in Chazal, according to our rabbis, when we want to talk about the base man, who we are at our lower primate level, we always talk about the ape, the monkey inside of us, kekayf bifnei adam. So in Africa, and that's how they still do it, when the Central Park wants some more monkeys and they order them from Africa, what do? They go out into the jungle and they take these heavy jugs with a narrow neck and they drop tasty nuts like macadamia nuts or walnuts inside. And the monkeys come and they smell them and they stick their arms into the jug and they grab a handful. And when they clench their fists and they try to remove it out of the narrow neck, their fists that are now clenched can't slip out. They can get in when they're open, but they can't now that they've created a bottleneck. So you would think the monkey would open its arm. But it can't because it smells that and it's in its mind, its fantasy, it's going to have it. But it won't let go of its fantasy, that nut that's in its hand, and it just sits there holding the nut until the villager comes, puts a net over it, and takes it, captures it, and brings it to the Central Park Zoo. Or if you live in one of the other many municipalities, we've gotten emails from Melbourne, Australia this week, and from Manchester, and we just got one from Vancouver, whichever local zoo you have. So what is it? That fantasy actually kills the monkey. Well, it doesn't kill it. It ends up in, but captures the monkey, and that's what it does to us too. That's what Chazal tell us. But what is that fantasy? Is it real? So let me share with you a story, fabulous story, that one of the great Mashgichim used this story. He said there was this villager, he had never been in a big city before, and he goes to the local town, And this is at the advent, just in the beginning of, you know, when electricity, etc. comes in. And he comes to the town. And he's shopping, and he'd never seen a supermarket before. And he's amazed. And he sees this box with a switch on it. And he says to the fellow, "What is it?" And the guy turns it on, and a blast of light comes from it. It's a powerful flashlight. "How much is it?" "It's $10. Amazing. He looks, he has money. He says, "I'll buy one." Takes it. And he looks at his clock. It's 2 hours left. He's supposed to rendezvous with the carriage that's taking him back to his village. And he's walking around, and he sees a building. And outside the building, there's a long line of people. He says, "What is this?" "It's a movie theater." "What's a movie theater?" "There's a projector, and there's a movie." "How much is it?" $5. He goes in. He's watching a movie. And it's a great drama. There's a heroine and a prince. And she gets separated, and there's an enemy who's hunting for her, and the prince is also looking for her, and she's hiding behind a rock, and the prince is just passing by. He's looking, but she doesn't know who's there, and she's hiding behind the rock. So this guy's sitting in the crowd, and he gets up, and he says, "He's there, he's there, look, he's there," and he turns on the light so that she could see the prince, and as soon as she turns on the flashlight, this huge beam, the whole place lights up, and you can't see the screen anymore. So the crowd turns around to him and they say, "Sit down, shut the light. Here, we can only see when the lights are off. You only see when it's dark." And that's what it is with fantasies. They only exist when the lights are off. Because once the lights are on, they dissipate. And that's what Chazal say. You know who has ruined so much happiness in life, so many marriages, so many jobs, so many careers, so many friendships? The other person, the other boy, the other girl, the other husband, the other wife. And they only exist when the lights are off. Turn a light on and they disappear. So what do Chazal call the other woman? A saita, a figment of our imagination. Let's go to our fabulous guests. With us, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt, who is really very unique. He's an assistant to the rabbi at the Young Israel of Woodmere. He's an associate rav of Anshei Chesed of Yulet. He's in his fourth cycle of giving the Daf Yomi Shir. He's a musmach of Rabbi Avram Vosner. He's the editor of the Laws of Bikkur Cholim, published by Art Scroll. But he's also the head of infectious diseases at South Nassau Hospital. So an unusual combination, much in the derech of the Rambam. Welcome, Rabbi Glatt.
Thank you very, very much. It's a pleasure to be on again.
So the topic is Metzitza Bepeh. According to New York City, approximately one child a year is infected with herpes via metzitza bepeh. And as a physician and a rav, I'd like to hear your opinion about the, would you, if somebody in your community came to you and said, "Our minig is to do metzitza bepeh, given the information at hand, should I or shouldn't I?" How would you respond?
Okay, this is a very, very complex question. And shaylos like this can be discussed in a Beis Medrash setting, can be discussed on a radio station or in an interview, but need to be asked to the person's rav, and there are many factors that need to be taken into consideration. So I can't paskin that shaylos for anybody, but I can point out what the potential shitos are and where a rav would ask the questions to decide what the appropriate psak is. There is clearly a mitzvah that's described in the Gemara of Metzitza Bepeh. This is an age-old custom, and certainly is something that is in our tradition, our Masorah, and should not be dispensed with without certainly halachic approval of the Gedolim and with appropriate situations. However, the Gemara in Shabbos tells us that if a Moel doesn't do certain aspects of the Milah, so then it's not considered the Bris Milah. But if it says, if he doesn't do metzitza, so the bris milah is technically a good bris milah, you don't let that moil be a moil anymore. So obviously there's a difference between doing certain aspects of a bris milah that are ma'akev, so to say, and the status of Mitzitza, which is clearly not Ma'akev. If you do a Bris Mila without Mitzitza, the Bris Mila is a kosher Bris Mila. So therefore, there is a huge difference between parts of the Mila that are absolute and Mitzitza, which is a very, very strongly recommended minhag to do Mitzitza. Now, I use the word minhag. Some say it's not a minhag. There are poskim that say that this is a halacha Moshe Mitzinai. It is a minority opinion, but the vast majority of the poskim would say that Mitzitza is either a din d'rabbanan or a minhag Yisrael. There is, of course, the famous Gemara in Shabbos that says that the reason for Mitzitza is to prevent essentially infection, essentially prevent some sort of a complication that would occur if you didn't do Mitzitza. So, essentially, everybody agrees that Mitzitza should be done. The question is, what does the Gemara mean when it says Mitzitza? So Mitzitza is possibly able to be done in a number of different ways. The simple understanding that we've had historically is that you do Mitzitza Bepeh, and it means Bepeh Mamish, that in order to prevent the baby from being in danger, the moil, or theoretically another person, would do Mitzitza Bepeh at the area of the Mila, and this was the way it was done for many, many years. In the 1800s, a very big controversy...
Oh, can I interrupt, Rabbi?
Sure.
Rabbi Glad is referring to a Gemara in Shabbos. It's on Kuf Lamed Gimel Amud Beis, where the Gemara says that a moel that does not do Mitzitza Mavirnoi, so you remove him, you take away his license. And the Gemara says, why? Gemara says, Pshita, Sakantahu. He's endangering the child, right?
Sure.
So the Gemara says clearly, it's very clear from the Lashon Gemara, that the entire purpose of Mitzitza is because it's for the health benefits of the child. And additionally, the Gemara says that on Shabbos, the reason you're allowed to do Mitzitza on Shabbos is because it's a sakana. It's very clear from the Shaka Vataria. So seemingly from the Gemara, the reason for Mitzitza Bepeh is not because it's part of the Maisa Mila, like Milo Priya, but it is for the health benefit of the child. That would be the, you know, the prima facie, the simple reading of the Gemara. And it is not until the Haskalah, the Reformation, came about that anybody tried to change this understanding. Is that correct, Rabbi Glatt?
To a large extent, yes. I think the turning point was in the 1800s, in different places in Europe, there were outbreaks that occurred, which today we probably would recognize as being herpes simplex type of outbreaks. In those days, they didn't have the ability to understand exactly what those infections were. There was a concern that they were syphilis. There was a concern that they were tuberculosis. They didn't have the ability medically to diagnose viral infections, and they didn't have the ability to diagnose the other infections that I just mentioned with the same accuracy that we can today. So there were outbreaks in wards, and they were associated with Mitzitza Bepeh. And the famous question was asked to the Chassam Sofer, would there be an alternative to doing Mitzitza Bepeh? The conditions that were being presented at that time as part of the Shaila from one of the Talmidim of the Chassam Sofer to his Rebbe from like 1837 to 1845, they had a correspondence, and these were that the governments would not have allowed Bris Mila to continue, but they would allow Bris Mila to continue if there was an alteration in the Mitzitza Bepeh. So this question was posed to the Chassam Sofer in correspondence with his Talmud, and the Chassam Sofer paskin that it would be permissible and allowable even lechatchila to do some sort of a mitzitza that was not done bepeh mamish, but that would accomplish the same thing that the Gemara in Shabbos that you just quoted wanted to have done to remove the danger.
Now Rabbi Glad is referring to a letter from Rabbi Eliezer Halevi Ish Horowitz. You have to assume that he's from the Shalaz family, a Levi from Prague, from the great, but he was the chief rabbi of Vienna, and it seems that there was some type of an epidemic where quite a number of children got ill and died post-Mila. So he writes a letter in 1837 to the Chassam Sofer, and the Chassam Sofer says, of course, Mitzitza was just for the benefit of the infant, and if the doctors say it's not necessary, you know, that it's a danger, so do the Mitzitza through a cloth, through using a sponge of some type. And he just, very simple tshuva, non-dramatic, just machzis avek with his arbol, like nothing.
Right.
That's the first we hear of it.
Right. And this tshuva essentially is quoted in the Mishnah Berurah. And when the Mishnah Berurah discusses this, he does bring this down with halacha, that metzitza can be accomplished without doing metzitza b'pem mamish. Now this tshuva from the Chassam Sofer was very, I don't like to use the word controversial, you know, this is Chassam Sofer's writing. The question is, subsequently, was this a tshuva ladoros, was this a horah ashah, was this a one-time special dispensation, or is this a recommendation for the future?
Now, and it is not brought down in tshuva's Chassam Sofer, by the way.
No, it was...
It's again, an extrajudicial tshuva that is from the correspondence. We have this from the correspondence of the Chief Rabbi of Vienna, this tshuva.
Right. So that's. I think there's a whole separate historical discussion and story about that, but we'll leave that for another time, as to why the tshuva was not in the current volumes that we have of the Chassam Sofer's tshuvas. But leaving that aside, the question is this the psak halacha that somebody should rely upon?
Now, interestingly, so, Rabbi Glatt, the Maram Shik, who was considered by many to be the Talmud with the Hei Hayadiyah of the Chassam Sofer, in Arachayim, in Kufnun Beis, did not see the above tshuva, and he says that you're absolutely not allowed to do, you're not allowed to be mevatel b'tzitza b'peh. He says, I'm for 40 years a moil, and anybody who says that mitzitza b'peh is dangerous is a complete liar, he says. That's the lashon of the Maram Shek. So he was obviously not aware of his Rebbe's tshuva at the time that he wrote his tshuva.
Right. And there are other explanations that are given as well for other Talmidim of the Chassam Sofer that apparently were aware of the tshuva. And the suggestion was that was just a horah ashah, and once the government stopped requiring the mitzitza b'peh be done in some other way, then you would go back to doing mitzitza b'peh. The bottom line is, there's different drachim in halacha. There are great poskim, including from the Briska dynasty, set over in the name of Chaim Briska, that mitzitza b'peh should not be done. The Rav, Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik Zatzal, quoted his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the son of Rav Chaim Briska, as being much more of a kanoi against doing mitzitza b'peh. And in the Nefesh HaRav from Rav Shechta Shlita, so he quotes a maisa that happened to Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld Shlita, the Rav of the Yungizel Kew Garden Hills, that when the Rav was present once at a milah, and the Moel did mitzitza b'peh, so Rav said, I'm not such a kanoi like my father. My father wouldn't have allowed him to do it. I don't recommend it, but I wouldn't stop them from doing it. So you have that derech, that since mitzitza b'peh was originally in the Gemara, as you described, done for the purposes of preventing sakana, so if modern medicine suggests that there is a sakana in doing mitzitza b'peh, so you can accomplish it using the svug of the Chassam Sofer, which today they don't do exactly the way the Chassam Sofer and the Yad Eliezer described, but they use a pipette, and they plug up a pipette so you can still accomplish the suction, but you don't have the direct touching of the mouth of the mile to the area of the wound, and that essentially eliminates even a theoretical risk of transmission from the mile to the baby of herpes simplex. Now, people have to understand that herpes simplex is not what people think about when they hear herpes. Herpes simplex is an infection, a viral infection, that probably 90% of the American population has been exposed to. It has nothing to do with doing Dvarim Asurim. It has nothing to do with the genital herpes that people talk about. It's a normal variant of the herpes simplex that's associated with genital herpes that is found very commonly in the mouths of people. And a person who gets it will always have it for the rest of his life, and they may potentially secrete the virus, have the virus in their mouth at any given time without necessarily having any symptoms. So the concern, and I'll point out, it isn't a proven route of transmission, but it's suggested from epidemiological evidence that a mile could, that's a potential, but the Department of Health certainly thinks it's a high potential, could transmit virus from his mouth to the baby. So if you hold from the poskim that say that you can do mitzitza b'peh via a svug or via pipette or some other mechanism and still be mekayim the mitzvah lichatchila, so then I would suggest that those poskim hold that it's also to do mitzitza b'peh mamish, because why do something dangerous when you can accomplish the mitzvah in the same exact way? If you, on the other hand, hold that this mitzitza b'peh is not just simply as the Gemara seems to suggest to prevent infection, but is a halacha lemoshe misinai, is a minority of poskim hold, or it's in fact part of the intrinsic mitzvah. So then, doing it in a non-mitzitza b'peh fashion is not keseder according to those poskim, and they would say unless the risk was reaching such a proven and high enough standard, then you're mechuyev to do it in the way that it's been time-honored to be done. So eilu ve'eilu divrei elokim chayim. Each person needs to ask their rav what their psak halacha is. If you hold like this, wonderful. If you hold like this, wonderful. So it's a machlokas in the base medrash. It shouldn't be a machlokas in terms of people yelling and screaming at each other.
So let me just go back to a number of points that you said. So the Chassam Sofer's tshuva that is brought from the Rav of Vienna that we have, some later authorities today have said that it could be mezuyif, it could be a forgery.
I think that's a very difficult thing to say. There's really no proof. I know that that has been posted. I've spoken about it myself, that people have mentioned that, but there really is no proof to that. And the Mishnah Berurah quotes it. The Yad Eliezer, this tshuva, is essentially quoted in the Mishnah Berurah. Once we start going into things being mezuyif, it's a very, very slippery slope.
But here's
not a shred of real evidence to suggest that it's mezuyif.
But here's a shred of evidence that is not mezuyif. Okay, I think more than a shred. If you look in the Chidush Chassam Sofer in Shabbos and Daf Kuvav Amud Aleph, the Chassam Sofer poses the following question. He says, since Metzitza is a Melacha Daraisa, because we pass Gindam Michbar Chavar, that the Dam is absorbed, so he says, why do we Daicha by Mila, why do we do Mila in the morning, and then do the Metzitza, which is Issa Daraisa, because of the Sakana to the Vlad, why don't we do Mila by Shkia, and then do the Metzitza post Shkia, so that this way you don't have to be Daicha Shabbos,
right,
for the Metzitza. Now, if the Metzitza would be part of the Mitzvah's Mila,
you have to do
it's an absurd question.
Yeah.
So clearly, the Chassam Sofer is learning that the Metzitza is not part of Mitzvah's Mila, and since it's not requirement of Mila, he says, I figured out a way how to not have to do Metzitza on Shabbos and not be Doicha Shabbos for Metzitza. Now, to say that the Chidush Chassam Sofer is also a forgery is really a stretch of the mind.
Yeah. It's a very difficult thing to say.
But here's the question. The question is that the reaction of both the Maram Shik and, interestingly, the Binyan Si and the Aruch Lener, who lived in Germany during the Reformation, who says it's halacha l'maisi misinai, there is no shred of evidence, and we have a lot of listeners, we have thousands of listeners, I ask you, can somebody find a Gemara anywhere that says that Metzitz is anything but a sakana and that it is part of Mitzvah's Mila? And I would put to you that both the Maram Shik and the Aruch Lener, who both lived during the period of Haskalah when they started tampering with the need for the entire Mila, when they said, no, you cannot tamper with Metzitz, it was really more of a political psak, which was saying, if we start tampering with Mila, even if halachically there's a reason for it, the next thing, the reform will abolish Mila totally, which is indeed what they try to do. But I can't think of, I've looked through the sugya, I can't find a single raya, a genuine raya, the Maria Sad struggles to find the makor, why, the Gemara says clearly, it's just because of sakana.
So I can answer that in two different ways. One, I agree with you. Secondly, the raya's you can bring, the Teferis Yisrael brings down that even if we don't understand something, we shouldn't dispense with it so quickly. And if the Gemara says, if you don't do Metzitz, it's a danger to the baby, despite the fact that modern medicine says that that doesn't make any sense to us, you shouldn't be so quick to dispense with it. That doesn't mean Metzitz b'peh mamish, that can mean just do Metzitz, which is why most, if not all of the poskim, still insist that Metzitza be done. It's just a question whether it be done bepeh, mamish, or whether you can use a svog, a pipette, or some other mechanism to accomplish the same thing.
So for Metzitza bepeh, then, there would be no makar then?
So there's a whole discussion that since people that are medakdek in the word Metzitza with two tzadis versus matzas with one tzadi, so some suggest over here that the Metzitza bepeh must be done bedafka bepeh mamish. Again, that's an argument that's made and can be argued against. But I would point out there's a very famous tshuva from the Shevet Alevi, Zatzal, Ravozna Zatzal, who was nifter a little bit more than a year ago. Certainly kedai to say over Divrei Torah in his name, relatively close to the yard site. He died Pesach, and we're in Shavuos, the Atzeres of Pesach. So Rav Ozner writes, what happens when you do a milah on a, let's say, a Russian emigre? You do a milah on a 40-year-old man. So he says, you don't do metzitza b'peh. And he says, the reasons are obvious. You don't do metzitza b'peh. He doesn't say what the reasons are. When he has dati, it is obvious. You don't do metzitza b'peh on an older man. It's inappropriate. Now, if there was an actual chiyuv to do this, we wouldn't say something's inappropriate. We don't say the milah is inappropriate doing it on an older man. We don't say doing the pri is inappropriate on an older man. But the metzitza obviously cannot be, in that situation, considered even a b'di'eved in any way that you should do it. The Rav Ozner says you shouldn't do it in that situation. Everybody would agree when there's a known reason not to do metzitza b'peh for another medical reason, you don't do metzitza b'peh. No moel should for a second think he should be doing metzitza b'peh if he has a lesion in his mouth. That would be crazy. So metzitza is a different setting than other aspects of the milah, and that's why you can have different gedolim paskening differently. So, but it shouldn't be a fight. Unfortunately, you see such kanois on both sides. People, you call you a rotzeach if you do it. They call you an avarian if you don't do it. It's a machlokis in the base medrash.
So, Rabbi Gwal, let me ask the following question: the incidence of metzitza creating an infection is someplace in the area of 1 in 50,000.
So I don't know if that figure is known.
That's according to New York City. Let's assume, for argument's sake, that it's an agreed upon number. So here's the question that I would ask you. Clearly, even if it's just ended up that way because of the Gemara, because of Sakana, it has become a minig of sorts by Kol Yisrael, because it's just the way we did the milah for thousands of years. So let me ask you now, you, let's say, are a proponent of Chassam Sofer, and you personally say, hey, I went to Yeshiva University, Rav Herschel Schechter said you could do it b'kli, there's no reason, but it is a minig of sorts. So here's my question. People go skiing all the time with their children. The rate of accidents in skiing is far, far greater than 1 in 50,000. Children play football in high school. The incidence of injury is far, far greater. And these are often children who don't understand what they're doing. Their parents say, sure, you on the football team, on the baseball team, you get hit by balls, by bats, certainly by other players, right? So why is it that even if you say, hey, I agree, it's not Mikra Din, but we have been doing it, 1 in 50,000? You know, football, skiing, vacation, why should we be mavatal it on a 1 in 50,000 chance?
So it's an interesting question that you brought up about skiing. So many of the rabbanim at Yeshiva University, my rabbanim, they don't permit you to go skiing if it's dangerous.
Well,
so
do they allow children to play football or
so
soccer?
Again,
I mean,
we have this concept of Dosh Be Rabim. We do have something. Rav Moshe in the Igros Moshe, he writes he couldn't aser smoking because he felt that it was something that was dosh be'rabim. So we have a heter to do certain things. The heter to play ball. So Rav Moshe also has a tshuva. He doesn't think you could be doing certain types of sports because they are too dangerous. But there is an idea that a person's allowed to do things that people accept as the common risks. So if this was a din and the risk is as low as you described, so then it's a different story.
It's Mila, a minig. Mila, but football, it's not less of a minig than football.
But the idea that something's a minig, it has to have the rationale behind it, has to have a purpose. If you can accomplish it the same exact way without doing b'peh mamish and the poskim that hold like that, you can't do this on your own, but you have great poskim to say it's perfectly acceptable. So then one can argue that you shouldn't put the child at risk. We don't know what the figures are. I don't know if that figure is correct. It could be too low. It could be too high. We really don't know. So if you have poskim that say, in this situation, don't do something that's dangerous, it doesn't mean that you can never do anything dangerous. How can you walk to shul on Shabbos? Nebuch, people get hit by a car. People get hit by a tree falling down and them walking to shul on Shabbos. Does that mean you should stay home on Shabbos? Rechmana litzlan. You're allowed to live life. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to do things. But it doesn't mean you should do something that is able to be accomplished in another way. Nobody would play football without a helmet. If you're playing football, at least put on a helmet.
So, Rabbi Glatt, in conclusion,
protective equipment.
Somebody in your shul comes to you and they have no minig one way or the other, and they should I do metzitza b'peh or not? What would you paskin?
So I tell him, my Rabbi and paskin, in this situation, you should do metzitza, but not b'peh mamish. You should do metzitza through a pipette. That's the psak if somebody comes to me. If they tell me they're a Talmud of the Maram Shik, that they're from a Hasidic family in Hungary, so then that may be a different psak for them, and they should ask their Rebbe. And if they have certainly a family tradition, there are ways to make Metzitza B'Pem Mamish safer also. Make sure somebody looks at the Moel's mouth. Make sure the Moel takes appropriate oral hygiene. Make sure the Moel washes his hands carefully. Make sure that the people that are taking care of the baby post-Metzitza don't have any herpes infections in their mouth. That's possibly a way that herpes could be transmitted post-bris milah. So all of these things, this is part of just good general health and hygiene that we all have to have. It's not specifically just the Metzitza B'Peh Shaila.
So a conversation with the Moel beforehand, perhaps about, does he have any infections in his mouth? Has he used mouthwash immediately prior? You say would be certainly a good conversation for anybody to
essential.
Have.
Well, yeah. To me, that's essential.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Rabbi Glatt. We have on the phone with us Dr. Daniel Berman. He's a physician whose specialty is infectious diseases. He works at Montefiore Medical Center as well as Einstein, and he was the physician that the Aguda used in court when they were defending the right to use Metzitza B'Peh. Welcome, Dr. Berman. I don't think I have him.
Hello, I'm here.
Oh, so hello, Dr. Berman.
Hello, hi.
So, Dr. Berman, can you tell us, we had on before Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt, and we discussed with him that there is an element of danger in Metzitza B'Peh. And the question would be, why would you as a physician allow it or suggest it to a parent, given that there is an element of danger in it? And that halachically, there seem to be ample grounds, certainly, not to do it, as the main purpose for it is because it's, you know, at the time it was believed it was v'toivas havlad, it was because there was a danger. And now we know that there are ways to do it without peh, and in fact, doing it orally could create a greater danger. So why would you suggest it?
That's a rather long question. I don't suggest anything. I'm not a Rav, so it's up to the Rabbanim to suggest or recommend doing Metzitza B'Peh or not. I am just an infectious disease physician who has studied a great deal about the nature of herpes simplex infection, and in particular with regard to the possibility of transmission through Metzitza B'Peh. So my comments are limited to the medical knowledge about the safety or not of performing Metzitza B'Peh.
So what can you tell us about the safety of performing Metzitza B'Peh?
Well, I can say that until today we really do not have any conclusive evidence that Metzitza B'Peh is a danger, is a physical danger. The there have been reports over the centuries of transmission of infections such as syphilis and tuberculosis. That was reported by Dr. Sprecher and his research. I can't say much about that because it was so many years ago. The recent claim has been that herpes simplex has been transmitted through Metzitza B'Peh, and until now there is no evidence for that. New York City had proposed some evidence. Their argument was based on several points. One point that they made was that there was biologic plausibility, meaning that it just made sense that it could be transmitted in this way, since it's known that there is a large percentage of the population infected with herpes simplex. So it's the numbers generally given are around 65% of the adult general population has been infected with herpes simplex 1. And among those, there are many of those who likely shed the virus intermittently in their saliva. The general percentage of times of what's called asymptomatic shedding, when the virus just is present in the saliva without causing any symptoms, is about 5%. So that in one of 20 times that one were to culture the saliva of someone of the 65% of the population infected with herpes, there's a one in 20 chance that there might be some virus detected in the saliva. So that's the biologic plausibility argument. The second argument that they made was that the distribution of lesions found in a number of boys, is consistent with transmission through Metzitza B'Peh. And the third argument that they made was that the incubation period of infection, meaning the time from the from the bris until the time, until when the lesions came out on the baby was consistent with acquisition of the infection at the time of the bris. And the last line of proof that they presented was a statistical analysis of the number of cases of herpes among boys who had Matisse of a pet. So in response to those four arguments, number one, none of them are the gold standard of evidence that we generally look for in proving transmission of viral infection. General way we would look for to prove transmission of viral infection would be through with DNA analysis, meaning that one would take the DNA of the herpes virus in the baby and match that to a DNA of the herpes virus if it could be found in the saliva of someone who's in contact with the baby. So if there's what is called a match, then that might be some evidence that there is transmission from one source, from source A to source B, if there is a DNA match. Now, having said that, even if there is a DNA match, there's no proof that it would have been transmitted through Matisse of a pen necessarily, because it could have been transmitted in another way, which I'll discuss. So in response to the biologic plausibility argument that it just makes sense, well, you know, that's a lot of things make sense but aren't true. So, for example, we know that hepatitis C is found in breast milk. So it's biologically plausible that it will be transmitted in breast milk, yet that's never happened. So biologic plausibility is a requirement to entertain a possibility of theory, but certainly doesn't prove anything. With regard to the distribution of lesions...
Rabbi Daniel, question for you. Mm-hmm. So you're saying if this was, let's say, a murder case, you would say the fact that somebody, licked the wound and then the person died of it, you would say you would actually have to have DNA that it was directing. And the fact that it's circumstantial evidence, but it is not beyond...
I'm discussing the circumstantial evidence. The elements of circumstantial evidence are, number one, the biologic plausibility, and I've responded to that. The other elements of circumstantial evidence are the incubation period and the distribution of lesions and the statistical, not the statistical analysis, but those two factors. So I'd like to address those points as to really they are, if they are circumstantial evidence or not.
Okay.
Right. So with regard to the distribution of lesions, it's known that any time there is a break in the skin, two points. One is that is an area where herpes might come in through any way that it comes in. And we know that herpes is a very contagious virus. The fact that 65% of the population is infected shows you how infectious it is. So anyone who has a cold sore, even without a cold sore, just has some shedding in the saliva and then touches the mouth and touches the baby can transmit the virus. It doesn't have to be a mohel. So furthermore, we know from the medical literature that if there is a break in the skin, in addition to that being a port of entrance for the virus, even if it's not the place of entry, even if the virus enters on another part of the body, the lesions will tend to break out in areas of previous trauma, such as a circumcision wound. So the distribution of lesions is just consistent with the fact that there happens to be an open wound at the time and is not circumstantial evidence that it's caused by Matisse of a pet. The second element of circumstantial evidence is the incubation period, which means the number of days between the bris and when the baby gets sick with herpes. So, in fact, we've looked at this very carefully, and in a number of cases, the incubation period did not match the expected incubation period at all. And furthermore, the incubation period is so wide that it really doesn't limit it in any way to the day of the bris, and it really would include any time from the birth of the baby until several days after the bris. So that piece of circumstantial evidence is not very helpful, and also, in a number of cases, was consistent with transmission, not at the time of the bris. So the circumstantial evidence just is not there. The statistical analysis has been attacked by a number of prominent statisticians who have all come to the same conclusion that there is no statistical evidence. So at the end of the day, there is no circumstantial evidence for this at all. Now, the best way to look at this is with DNA testing. And fortunately, there has been some DNA testing finally done with the cooperation of the Rockland County Health Department. So this was a study done in cooperation between the Frum Jewish community and the Rockland County Health Department, where they looked at several cases. So there were three cases that were studied by the cooperation of New York State Laboratory through the Rockland County Health Department. The first case was inconclusive, meaning that there was not enough virus detected in order to do the appropriate matching. The second two cases of herpes with the same distribution of lesions show that it was not from the mohel in either case. These were two different babies, two different mohels, and the DNA that the baby got there, in fact, the two babies were infected with the same distribution of lesions around the genitalia. Despite that so-called circumstantial evidence, the DNA evidence showed that it did not come from the mohel. So the only two cases that we were able to look at showed conclusively that the mohel was not the source.
Well, thank you very, very much. We appreciate your time.
Okay.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Right.
We have with us the esteemed Rabbi Chaim David Zwiebel, the Executive Vice President of the Venerable Agudas Yisrael. He's an attorney by trade. He's also received the President, he's also a President Reagan appointee to the National Commission on Children. Condoleezza Rice appointed him to the U.S. Delegation for Security regarding anti-Semitism and intolerance. It's an honor to have you with us, Rabbi Zwiebel.
Thank you so very much, Rabbi David.
So one of the topics in the forefront of the news for the last, I would say, number of years has been metzitza bepeh, which is oral suction done during a bris milah. And the Aguda has clearly come out in favor of it and has, you know, tried to work out all kinds of compromises with the city government, etc. Could you give us a little background on that?
Sure. And just to clarify, it's not so much that Aguda has come out in favor of the practice of metzitza bepeh, which is actually something that's the subject of different minhagim in Klal Yisrael, different mesiris, different hairois by different gedolei poskim, and different communities follow different traditions in this respect. There are many for whom the metzitza that is required can be accomplished and is accomplished through a little glass pipe, and to them that's a lachatchila. It's not a bidyevet, and many within the constituency of Agudas Yisrael, as a matter of fact, would hold to that halachic opinion and halachic mesira through their particular communities. But then there are others, many others, for whom metzitza bepeh must be done directly through oral suction, directly with the mouth, and not through any intermediary keli. And for them, that is part and parcel of the mitzvah of bris milah. So our role as a national umbrella-type organization that tries to bring in all the different factions of Klal Yisrael and to fight to preserve the rights of all different factions of Klal Yisrael, when there were issues regarding the possibility of banning the practice of bris milah, of metzitza bepeh, or regulating it in significant ways, which could have had a severe impact on that section of the community that does observe metzitza bepeh as an integral part of the mitzvah, that's something which our gedolim, including those gedolim, by the way, who personally in their own messiah is not to do metzitza directly bepeh, but to a keli. But all of the gedolim who sit at the table of the Moetz Gedolei HaTorah felt that this was an issue that impacted Klal Yisrael. Certainly that portion, that very significant portion of Klal Yisrael that holds that metzitza bepeh is an integral part of the mitzvah of bris milah. And then even beyond that, when Mayor Bloomberg in New York City worked toward a regulation that would have in some small way regulated the practice of metzitza bepeh, this represented the very first time in the history of the United States that a governmental body had taken an action to regulate an aspect of bris milah. And given the climate of what we see going on all across the globe, here in the United States, there was a ballot referendum initially set to be put before the voters in San Francisco that would have said that circumcision, not metzitza bepeh, circumcision could not be performed on a minor, and that only when a person had reached the age of majority, meaning 18 years old, could he then decide on his own to have himself circumcised. In other countries around the world, there have been a number of efforts to restrict the practice of bris milah, bris milah itself. There is a growing no-circ movement, so to say, no circumcision, which is pressing governmental bodies to prohibit or very severely limit the practice of circumcision. So given that climate, our Gedolim felt that it was very important that at the very first sign of a governmental encroachment upon what had been understood all these years to be sacrosanct, the government couldn't start up with an essential religious practice like bris milah, but here, for the very first time, Mayor Bloomberg did that, and they felt that that was something which had to be resisted, and we had to send the message that bris milah is sacrosanct, it cannot be interfered with or regulated by government, whatever internal measures we need to take as a community to make sure that bris milah is done in as safe and sanitary a fashion as is possible, those are steps that we should be taking internally. But once government starts imposing its will upon a mitzvah like this, that's a very dangerous step. So we joined together, the Aguda, together with the Satmar community, together with the Chabad community, and challenged Mayor Bloomberg's regulation of the practice of mitzvah peh. Actually, the U.S. Court of Appeals won a very significant victory in this case. And now Mayor de Blasio has taken the initial steps towards having this regulation removed. So that's the long-winded response to your question, Rav David, but I hope it will give your listeners a sense of why we felt that this was such an important matter to take on and why we are so pleased that, in fact, the current mayor of New York City, the current incumbent, de Blasio, has agreed to take steps that would remove the city from its role as regulator of an aspect of this very chashuv mitzvah.
So let me ask you a question, Rabbi Zwiebel. How would you explain to a secular person, there have been, and I don't really want, I don't think we should get into whether it's true or not, but there have been a number of medical papers published that say that there have been 11 cases of neonatal herpes, or 17 cases, or 24 cases, whatever the number is, and endangered the lives of the children, right? And we're taking the position as a community, well, we have a right to bris milah, and even though it endangers, don't, constrict religious values. How would you juxtapose that with, let's say, for example, others who say we can't give our agunis gittin, and therefore some people, wrongfully went ahead and beat up people to be able to allow for a get. So clearly the rule of law at some point has injuries annually.
Yeah, there you go. So, there are certain things that society would never start up with. We can't start up with football, right? We can't start up with football. That's as American as apple pie and all the other great things, and today football is probably a lot more American than apple pie is. So you can't start up with that, despite the fact that we as a society know that this practice, football is something which is quite a higher level of danger and risk, certainly, than any possibility of infection transmitted through mitzitza bepeh. So, when society picks and chooses which types of activities it wants to regulate and those that it chooses not to regulate, it's making a value judgment that there's something about football that is so essential to our community and our society, we're not going to start up with that. But on the other hand, when it comes to bris milah, we understand that some, old-fashioned Jews insist on doing this practice as part of their religious ritual, but we know better, and this is not that important to us, and therefore we're going to take steps to try and eradicate that practice. But I do want to mention that I think it's important for us as a community not to in any way try to minimize the seriousness of the concerns that have been raised. We ourselves as a community would be very well served if we would know the facts. I mentioned before that there is a difference within the medical community. Though the experts that we produced in the litigation did not say with certainty that Mitzitza B'Peh has never, ever caused the transmission of an infection, of a herpes infection, from the male to the child. They can't say that with certainty. There are ways of determining with greater certainty through DNA testing, which has started to happen in Rockland County, and which we hope will happen in New York City as well, to establish more definitively what the source of a child's herpes infection might be, whether there is a direct connection to the male or not, or maybe it was a different caregiver who might have transmitted, or who knows what. But it's important for us to get this information. It's important for our Rabbanim to study this information. It's certainly important for us to develop a set of best practices for our Mayalim to make sure that Mayalim are taking whatever possible steps they can take to minimize the very slim risk that may exist of transmission of an infection. Obviously, our children are our most precious resource.
Well, thank you very much. It was really a great honor, and it was great to have the clarification on many issues. You've heard where we've been speaking to the esteemed Rabbi Chaim David Zwiebel, the erudite, articulate executive vice president of the Agudas Yisrael, an organization. We have the honor of having with us on the phone the famous Hasidus Shemoyel, Harav Rav Mordechai Cohen. Welcome, Rav Cohen.
Thank you.
Rav Cohen, can you just give us a little introduction? How long have you been a Mayel?
Okay, when I started the first Mila in Toshia Chof Hei. Now we are in Toshia and Ayin Vav, and you figure it out. It's over the Yovel years.
Over 50 years.
That started. I can't say that, I was a professional then, but about 5 years later, I was on my own.
So how many brisin do you think you've done over that period?
Well, I think it's close to 14,000 to 15,000.
I'm sorry?
I have recorded all of them, but I don't have the exact number. It's probably close to 14,000 to 15,000.
14 or 15,000. Wow! Can
between
I?
That, yes. Yeah.
Wow!
I have seen over 20,000, for sure, because we have here like a nursery, like a Kippertonheim, where mothers come with the babies after the bris, and I'm in charge to check the babies the day or two after the bris. So in all, I've surely seen well over 20,000 babies after the bris.
And who taught you Mila?
My father, Chaim Brecha. He was a very famous mind.
And where was he a mile?
His name was Rabbi Hananya Cohen. A lot of people remember him very well. He lived in Williamsburg.
And where was he from?
He was from Budapest.
And who taught him Mila?
His father.
Wow.
I'm a fourth generation mile, as far as I know.
And your father was a Chassidus Shiid?
No, he was an Ashkenaz. He was a Rebbe. So my Messiah is real as Ashkenaz. You introduced me as a Hasidic Shemoyel. I grew up between Hasidim, but my Messiah is really Ashkenaz.
When you say Ashkenaz, like Chassam Sofer, like what?
That's right. Well, it was Talmid Chassam Sofer. My grandparents, Talmid Chassam Sofer, right.
Yes. Through who? Like
my father was actually a Talmud of Pittsburgh, but he keeps a from the Baruch. He learned in Pittsburgh.
Uh-huh. So I'm sure of Rav Cohen that you do Mitzitza B'Peh, right?
Definitely. Not only I do, I would accept the bris without Mitzitza B'Peh.
You would not do it without it?
No. I had calls that they wanted.
And what do you do when a parent says that they're worried about the danger?
I explain to them that I appreciate their concern. I try to explain to the father that the dangers that he read about or heard about are really what I believe is baseless. I'll explain a little later. And I try to explain this to them. I explain that, I have at least over 40 years experience or 45 years experience. And by saying all these babies, I never saw herpes. Never saw infections, and not only the business that I made, also the all these babies that I see are all done with Mitzitza B'Peh, with other mahalim, and I never saw these complications. By the way, I knew a doctor here in Muncie who had an office for about 25 years in Muncie, by the Heimish Oilam, and he was, when it started this, the shuas about Mitzitza B'Peh, he was reluctant. So I asked him, tell me the truth, how many times did you see herpes in babies in your practice? You know what the answer? Never.
So when New York City says they have seen it and doctors have seen it, what do you think they're lying?
Baruch Hashem, that it's very, very much exaggerated. I'll tell you the truth. If it would be true what they wrote, the Hashbonos, I don't think you would find one mile with its own right mind who would make Mephisto there. And they would surely have Hatayram not to do Mephisto there, if that would be true. Because we were all the years more concerned about the health of the baby than doctors. You know, there are a lot of, I'm not saying they're not concerned, but there are a lot of things that they allow you to do with a bris. And since we go with the Messiah and the Halacha, we will not do a bris.
What I'm trying to say is if you believe
there is really a chashash, you would not do Mephisto Beper.
So Rabbi Cohen...
Although the whole Chaimed. I'll explain earlier. I will not say that everything is right-out lie. Some of the talk is right-out lie. If somebody tells me that he saw 15 cases in Colombia a year, that's outright lie. But if they have something, not some numbers, that they found herpes in babies after a bris, the mice, they were all proven that had nothing to do with the bris. Or it was completely proven it had not to do with the bris, or at least they couldn't prove it was from the bris. So I could tell you, Mishonen, that I know that babies went to the hospital because the doctor was suspecting herpes. They put him right away on the medications for herpes, and they kept him 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and the mice, they were mavare, had nothing to do with herpes. It was a mistake. Let me freya.
So Rabbi Cohen is...
But they didn't take off record that these babies did not have herpes.
So
they stayed on the record that they had so much babies with herpes.
So Rabbi Cohen is... So let me say, is it fair to say then that you're saying that if indeed it was dangerous, you would do not bepeh, but you feel that in all your years you've seen it, you've never had, and you've done 15,000 brisin personally, and you've seen 20,000, you've never seen a case of herpes.
Right.
So you feel it's extremely exaggerated.
100%.
So really, there's no reason to change the Mesira for something that you've never seen, and it's mamish amilsa deloy shchiach. So why change the Mesira? But if it were indeed, what happened? You say, ain't a chanami, you would, but it's a myth. It's sort of an illusion.
That's right. That is true. But they're right. That would be enough milsa d'shchicha for me if they would prove it. That is somewhere from this that I would refrain from doing it.
So let's say the tshuva of the Chassam Sofer.
Yes.
Let's say, which was in Wien, in a case where there was an outbreak, and he said, in a case of an outbreak, you should not do Metzitza Bepeh. Right. You would say, if there was an outbreak, Einachanami, in that particular case, you should not
in
do
that
it.
Because that's right, yes. I'll tell you, years ago, when it was an outbreak of AIDS, Rahman al-Salam, it was very new to everyone, even to the medical profession. We were very scared. We were scared of first of all, for ourselves, and then Hashem should spread it. Baruch Hashem, Adayayim, we never heard about cases that were spread through Metzitza. But there were some Rabbonim who heard the facts, how far they didn't know, you know, how to spread and everything. They were afraid that they'll have to make a Hayroi Shah, not to make Metzitza Bepeh.
Wow. Yeah. Well, thank you very, very much, Rav Cohen.
Thank you so much.
Okay? All the best.
Yeah.
Call it to the bye-bye.